I want you to take a moment and imagine an opening scene to a movie. You hear as the screen begins to come to view and the opening credits are gone, you begin to hear Beach Boys tunes, something happy and bouncy. And then the camera focuses in on a family in their home preparing for a fun day at the beach, packing the cooler. They're grabbing their swimsuits and their towels and lathering up the sunscreen, getting their sunglasses together and their beach umbrella and their toys to play in the sand and all this stuff. This is just going to be a great day. And you watch as they pile into the car. And they're all singing the Beach Boys tunes together as they're driving with the windows down and the sunroof open. And there's a beautiful sky. It's going to be a perfect day at the beach. You can just tell. You can sense. This is just an incredible opening scene to this movie. And there's nothing that can stop a great day at the beach for this family. Okay, that's the opening scene. Now, I want you to take a second. I want you to imagine what happens next. Now seriously, I want you to stop and just think for a second. If you're writing this movie, what happens next? There is a best-selling author and researcher named Brené Brown, and in a lecture she shares this exact same scenario, and she asks the audience to share with her, what do you think happens next? And almost universally, this bouncy Beach Boys beach day ends up somehow or another into a tragedy. One of the kids throws up in the car, one audience member says. Somebody else says, well, the mom and the dad start fighting, and then you realize, wow, it looks great, but this family has serious issues. Somebody else says, well, a Mack truck smacks into the car right as they're about to get off on their exit to the beach. For somebody else, maybe a bit more imaginative, there's a zombie apocalypse that's overtaken the beach. But almost universally, and maybe you did it in your mind too, almost universally, we hear this opening idyllic scene, and almost universally, her hearers turn it into something horrible, a tragedy. And author Mike Cosper asks, why is it that we do that? And his reason is that we are suspicious of joy. We're suspicious of joy. Anybody relate to that? We carry about within us this deep-seated suspicion that happily ever afters really happen. We have this deep-seated suspicion that bubbly beach days really always turn out so good in the end. Now, you would think with this sort of cynicism that, if we're honest, many of us carry within us, you would think with this sort of deep-seated cynicism that we would hold on to all of our stuff very loosely. In other words, if you are suspecting something bad's going to happen every time you go around the corner, you're not going to hold on to anything too tightly because you're going to lose it anyways. But the reality is the exact opposite happens. Instead of holding on to everything really loosely, what do? We cling to it. We hold on to it tighter. If you're afraid that every beach day ends in a disaster, you stop going to the beach. And in doing that, in avoiding that risk, you may protect yourself from 1,000 different tragedies, but you never see the ocean. This morning, I want to talk to you from the book of Esther about the rightness of risk. The rightness of risk. The truth is, many of us, if we're honest, are playing it safe. We're living comfortably, secure, safe. Easy. And I want to show you from Esther chapter 4 that everything that you think is safe and secure is really a myth and a mirage. Your best attempts at safety and security will not protect you. And I want to show you that the path to the greatest reward is often the path of the greatest risk. But in order to do that, let's recap a little bit of where we've been in the book of Esther. If you've been with us the past few weeks, you know that the story begins with this powerful king, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called in the Hebrew Scriptures. And Xerxes has incredible power, incredible wealth, and he decides to show all of it off to his buddies, drinking buddies right there in ancient Persia. And he, to top it all off, says, "I want to show you my wife, Queen Vashti. I guarantee you she looks better than your wife does." And so he summons Vashti, and Vashti says no. The king is obviously humiliated, as in front of his friends, his wife refuses to come, and so she's fired. You can imagine your best Donald Trump voice, "You're fired." That's King Xerxes. Fires Vashti, and a few years later, after an unsuccessful attempt to conquer Greece, King Xerxes, upon recommendation from his eunuchs, decides to get a new wife. And so they take all the virgins in the land, the beautiful virgins, and they bring them to the harem. And the one that pleases Xerxes the most becomes his new blushing bride, the queen. And that girl just so happens to be a young lady of Jewish descent named Esther. Sometimes we're tempted to think cute, sweet, beautiful little Esther. But as we've seen, the reality is Esther is a compromised young lady. She's an assimilated Jew. She's named after Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of sex and war. She's hiding her Jewish identity, and she's actively winning favor of everybody in the empire. Meanwhile, there's a man, the villain of the story, named Haman. If you want to remember Haman, just think, "Hey, man!" That was free. And Haman is this incredible villain. And he decides, after being promoted to the prime minister, the second most powerful man in the entire empire, he decides to slaughter the entire Jewish race. So why? Because his pride was hurt. One man, a Jew named Mordecai, which is also Esther's second cousin, decides not to bow before Haman. And so Haman goes to the king, and he convinces the king to issue an edict that on the 13th day of the month of Adar, 11 months from this moment in the story, the Jewish people will be annihilated. That's where we left off last week. So imagine the scene in the empire. What I want us to do at the beginning of chapter 4 is I want you to notice that there's two locations, and depending upon where you are in the empire, you're responding to this news in one of two ways. Here's the two locations. There's the provinces, and there's the palace. In the provinces, you'll notice in the first few verses of chapter 1, there's weeping and mourning and wailing. The Bible says Mordecai rips his clothes. This was a sign of incredible agony and mourning. He puts sackcloth on, which would be like itchy garments that aren't comfortable. He puts ashes on his face and head. He begins to wail and moan in the city. He is dressed up like a public mourner, and he's going throughout the provinces. And this is the way all of the Jewish people everywhere are responding to this news. He's absolutely devastated. And then there is the palace. In the palace, if you look at chapter 3, verse 15, two of our main characters, Haman and Xerxes, are doing what? They're drinking. Having a grand old time. While the entire empire is in confusion, Xerxes and Haman are enjoying themselves. But there's another main character that's also in the palace, and her name is Esther. And the surprising thing is that Esther looks little different than Haman and Xerxes, at least at first. You see, Esther finds out that Mordecai, her cousin, is weeping and mourning, and he's wandering about the empire, the provinces, in sackcloth and ashes. But the empire had this rule. Here's the rule. You'll see it in verse 2. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Here's the rule of the palace. You're not allowed to look sad in the presence of the king. Think Stepford Wives sort of deal, right? You got to look happy. Think Snapchat filters and social media, right? I mean, you're going to look happy. Put on a smiling face. Life is beautiful and wonderful. Don't be sad in the presence of the empire. Esther finds out that Mordecai is dressed in the badges of sadness just outside the palace walls. And what does she do? Mordecai, what's wrong? Mordecai, can I help you? Mordecai, why are you sad? No, that's not what she does. Notice what she does in verse 4. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. What does Esther do? She tries to get Mordecai to be happy. In other words, Esther looks just like the empire. She just looks just like the people in the palace. Her first response is not, why are you sad? Why are you grieving? Why are you mourning? What's wrong? Her first response is, here's some Tommy Hilfiger, put it on. You can tell I'm a 90s kid, right? Tommy Hilfiger, what in the world? So, here's some clothes, get dressed, wear something nice. You can't look like that. Get in the palace with me. These are the two approaches to suffering in our world today. Some people are in the provinces. Some people are deeply affected by suffering. They're wounded by it. They're broken by it. They're grieving. They're in sackcloth and ashes. They're devastated. And some people are secluded in luxury in the palace. So let me ask you this morning, dear brother, sister, friend, where are you? In the palace or in the provinces? Are you deeply broken and affected by the suffering in our world, or are you wonderfully secluded from it? I think perhaps for many of you, your first response is to say, oh, I'm definitely in the provinces. I mean, I'm no one percenter now. I'm not living in a palace. I'm just an ordinary guy. I'm an ordinary gal. That's not me. But let me remind you that if we look at the whole world empire, the truth is probably most of us, if not all of us, are living in the palace. You say, what do you mean? Well, my fellow Americans, you live in a country that spends $350 million a year on Halloween costumes for pets. Randy Alcorn says, if you made, get this, $1,500 last year, if you made $1,500 last year, that's more than 80% of the people on earth. Statistically, If you have sufficient food, decent clothes, live in a house or an apartment, and have a reasonably reliable means of transportation, you are among the top 15% of the world's wealthy. If you have any money saved, a hobby that requires some equipment or supplies, a variety of clothes in your closet, two cars in any condition, and live in your own home, you are in the top 5% of the world's wealthy. Ronald Sider, in his book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, says that there are 18,000 children that die every day, mostly of hunger and preventable diseases. 18,000 in the provinces dying every day. 1.25 billion people on our globe survive or struggle to survive on less than $1.25 a day. Another 1.2 billion people in our world live on $2 or less a day, which means that a third of the planet makes less money a day than you spend on the stick that you rub under your arm. So let me ask you again, my friend, are you in the provinces or in the palace? To my Pocosin friends this morning, if you make the median household income in the city of Pocosin or higher, you're in the top richest 0.2% of the world. Realize that. If you make the median income of our city, you are in the top 0.2% of the world's population. I think it's safe to say even the most struggling person in this room is somehow or another living in the palace. Now, before we move on, I do not say that to make you feel guilty. As Mordecai will shortly say to Esther, who knows if you have been put here for such a time as this? If you are in the palace, the question is, what are you going to do with what you've got? Will you cling to it, or will you risk? There's a second thing we want to see as we keep working through this story together. Not just two locations, but two dangers. So here's one of the myths about living in the palace. We tell ourselves, if we live in this luxury, we are safe. But the truth is, we who live in the palace are prone, susceptible to two dangers that those living in the provinces don't know about. In other words, you're not safe, friend, no matter how much you prioritize safety and security. There's two dangers. The first is insulation. So think about it for just a moment. Let's try a new experiment in parenting. This is always a bad idea, but we'll go with it. So let's say that you decide to raise your child insulated from anything bacterial or viral that could ever harm them. Some of you are like, yeah, I do that all the time. I'm a germaphobe, right? Well, let's just say that you totally insulate your children, bubble boy sort of deal. Totally insulate your children so that they are never brought in contact with anything bacterial or viral that could ever harm them. And let's say they hit 21 and they decide at 21, I'm going to go spend a night on the New York City subway. Or to make it worse, I'm going to spend 3 hours in a daycare. What happens to the person who has been so insulated? They're wrecked, right? I mean, if you have been insulated from any sort of suffering, any sort of sickness, any sort of pain for your entire life, you are more, not less, susceptible to the dangers of the world outside you. And that's exactly what happens inside the palace. We insulate ourselves from suffering, from pain, from brokenness, from lostness, and the tiniest exposure to it wrecks us. I suggest to you that's what's happened to Esther. It's interesting that Esther, after Mordecai refuses the clothes that she gives him, she doesn't even realize what's going on. You look at verse 5, and she takes this guy Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, and she says, find out what's going on. Why is it that Mordecai is sad? I mean, this is almost hard to believe. The king has sent his horsemen throughout the entire empire, 127 provinces. Incidentally, did you realize that one of the old mottos for the Pony Express was actually copy-pasted from Xerxes' Pony Express? That was free too. There you go. These guys were spreading the news everywhere. 127 provinces, everybody knows. Except Esther. Isn't that just like us? How much do we know about the suffering in the world around us? How much do we know about the brokenness, the lostness, the destruction in the world around us? Are we insulated from it? That's Esther. But there's another danger, because here's the deal. When you insulate yourself from brokenness and suffering and pain and death and lostness, in the end, you have more to lose than anybody. And that's Esther. Because Esther, living in the luxuries of the palace, she has incredible influence, and she doesn't want to use it. See, if you're living in the palace, if you have luxury and resources and wisdom and education and insight, and most importantly, a relationship with Jesus Christ, if you have access to the Word of God, you have all of these things living in the palace, that means you have influence, you have ability to actually do something about the pain and brokenness in our world. This would be a great time to insert a Spider-Man quote. With great power comes what? Great responsibility. You live in the palace, and all of a sudden, you are susceptible to a different kind of danger. That is the danger of influence. In other words, we can't expect the people in the provinces to be able to alleviate their own suffering. They don't have the resources to do it. You can't expect the lost to win themselves to Christ. They don't know the gospel. We have the resources. We have the ability. We have the influence. And so Mordecai says to Esther, you've got to do something. You've got to go to the king. You've got to take your influence. You've got to use it to bring about the salvation of our people. And notice the way that Esther responds. And here we'll see that there are two choices ultimately that Esther has. She can either risk now, or she can risk later. Look at Esther's response after Mordecai invites her to get involved in verse 10. Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. Now, if you look at the surface of what Esther is saying, she appears to be saying, Mordecai, I can't do anything. Don't you realize I'm powerless? I don't have any power. I can't even visit the king unless he calls for me. There's a law in ancient Persia that if you visit the king and he doesn't extend his golden scepter to you, then you will die. Archaeologists have discovered artwork from ancient Persia And there you see a Persian king sitting on a throne with a golden scepter, and behind him is a man with a big axe. Don't you realize, Mordecai? I'll lose my head. I don't have any power. I can't come and go before the king. I don't have the right to go there. And that's what many of us think. How can I do anything? What power do I have? What ability do I have? What do I have to offer? And then she says something else that's interesting. The king hasn't called me in 30 days. Now, if you know anything about King Xerxes, you can just about guarantee he hasn't been sleeping alone for 30 days. But Esther has fallen out of favor. She's not the woman of the week anymore. King Xerxes has moved on. And Esther says, don't you realize I've fallen out of favor with the king? I don't have power. I don't have influence. You think that I can do all this stuff, but I can't. And again, this is like much of us, isn't it? God only uses the strong. I'm just not strong enough. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. God uses priests and pastors and prophets and missionaries and Sunday school teachers. He doesn't use normal people. Or does he? Incidentally, it's interesting that there's not a priest or a prophet or a pastor or a Sunday school teacher mentioned in the entire book of Esther. God's people are saved with a compromised Jewish girl and a politician named Mordecai. Said, God can't use me. Really? I think Mordecai sees what's really going on in Esther's heart. You see, Esther, her response on its face, what she's saying is, I can't do anything, Mordecai. But look at the way that Mordecai responds to her. Mordecai knows what Esther's really saying underneath it all is that I don't want to risk it. So what do you mean? Look at verse 12. They told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai knows what's really going on in Esther's heart. Esther's afraid to risk it. And notice what Mordecai says. Esther, listen, you have two choices. Risk now or risk later. Do you really think, Esther, if Haman's going to kill all the Jews, that you won't be sniffed out? That's what he's saying. He says, do you think that you'll be able to escape? In other words, risk now or risk later. And then he says, well, even if you could escape. Verse 14, you and your father's house will perish. What is he saying? What does he mean, you'll perish? I think what Mordecai is saying is, Esther, you will be cut off from the people of God forever. In other words, Esther, you might live in the palace for another 50 years, but you'll go to hell in the end. Esther, risk now or risk later. That's essentially what he's saying. You can sacrifice for your people now, or you will sacrifice later. Now, it's interesting. Jesus told a number of parables, but there's only one parable that Jesus ever told where he named the characters in the parable. You may know the story of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man had his good things on this earth. Lazarus was poor in this earth. The rich man never helped Lazarus, and Lazarus goes to glory. The rich man goes to hell. And I heard Tim Keller talking about that parable before, and he said, people always ask, why is it that Lazarus gets a name, but not the rich man? And here's what Tim Keller said. The point is that the rich man is his name. So what do you mean? Riches have so defined him that they become who he is. He can't even imagine an existence apart from his stuff. And this is what happens to us. This is the danger of life in the palace. This is why sermons on risk can so easily fall on deaf ears, is because we begin to process things and think, well, if I lose this, if I lose that, I won't be me anymore. For this rich man, if he loses his riches, that's all he has. And that's Esther. And that's many of us, if we're honest. For us, we're afraid to risk and obey even when it hurts, because we're afraid that in the end we'll lose everything. Esther will risk. The only question is, will she risk now or will she risk later? Let me say something to you, brothers and sisters, my church family here this morning. The only way out of suffering is through it. The only way out of suffering is through it. You try to live your life escaping and avoiding suffering, all you will do is postpone it. Jesus puts it this way in Luke chapter 9. In Luke chapter 9, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? You could say, what does it profit a woman if she lives in the palace but loses herself? Christian, what does it profit you if you gain everything but end up losing it all in the end? There are two choices for Esther, and there are two choices for us. Will we risk now, or will we risk later? If you're here and you're not a follower of Jesus, let me just take a moment and remind you. If you're afraid of what it will cost you to actually follow Jesus, it will cost you far more later if you don't. Christian, living in the palace, stockpiling resources and luxuries and living for comfort and ease, if you're afraid of what it would cost you to live with radical abandonment for the good of the suffering lostness around you, let me remind you that it will cost you far more if you don't. Well, there's good news in our story, because Esther does something absolutely incredible. She changes. She changes. She's been a pretty one-dimensional character so far in the story. She's an outwardly beautiful, assimilated Jewish girl. But she's about to become truly beautiful. Notice what she says to Mordecai. Verse 15. Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young woman will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Esther makes two sacrifices, the sacrifice of identification and the sacrifice of intercession. First, she identifies with her people. This entire story, and it's been years since the story began, this entire story, Esther has hidden her Jewishness. She has refused, under the instructions of Mordecai, she has refused to identify with the people of God. But right here, she chooses to identify with them. What is she doing? She's going to call a fast, and all the Jews are going to fast. And guess what? I'm going to fast too. In other words, Esther, for the first time, is letting the world know that she is a Jew. You've got to stop and think about what that means. Because the moment she identifies with the people of God is the moment that she also identifies with their death sentence. Right? The people of God are under a death sentence. All of them are going to die. And when she says, I am one of them, she is saying, I too am under this edict. She identifies with them. But she doesn't just identify and fast with the Jewish people, because that would save nobody. See, Esther could fast and identify with the Jewish people all she wanted. But if someone doesn't go into the presence of the king and intercede for God's people on behalf of them, then they will still die. And so what does Esther do? She says, if I perish, I perish. By the way, we know the way the story ends, but Esther didn't. When she says, if I perish, I perish, she's not winking. She's not crossing her fingers. We all know how it turns out in the end. It's not a Marvel movie where everybody comes back, okay? This is real life. This is real life. And Esther knows that by going to see the king, she could have her head removed from her body. And she does. And she goes before the king. And in God's providence, the king extends the golden scepter to her. But what's interesting to me is that Esther, she's summoned up all of this courage, right? She's taken this brave step. She's a changed character. Incredible things are happening in her heart and life. She's looking beautiful, truly beautiful, for the first time. She goes and he says, half the kingdom, whatever you want. And she says, can we go out on a date? And bring Haman. You would think that she would say, okay, perfect timing. Save my people. She doesn't. Why? We don't know. It doesn't tell us. Is she afraid? Does she get cold feet? We don't know. But she doesn't. And then Haman and the king go to Esther's house, apartment, whatever it is. And they have this big feast. And the king does it again. Whatever you want, tell me, my love. What do you want? And she says, let's do it again. Let's eat again. And then I'll tell you. Why is she doing it? We don't know. We have no clue. There's no hint anywhere about why she's doing this. But she's doing something. And in the providence of God, God will use Esther's decision to delay this question for the good of his people. Now, I told you I wanted to talk to you this morning about the rightness of risk. But what I don't want you to do is hear this story and say, all right, I'm going to be like Esther. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm going to risk, and I'm going to do great things, and I'm going to be like Esther to the glory of God. I don't want you to do that yet. Because Esther is not first given to us as an example, but as a signpost. In other words, Esther, the story of Esther is not here first and foremost so that you will see her courage and say, let me be like that. No, she's given to us here first and foremost so that we will look beyond Esther to a greater deliverer. It's interesting that, according to chapter 5, verse 1, is it 5? Yeah, 5 verse 1. I lost my place. It's on the third day that Esther appears before the king. You may not have heard of this, but there's these Jewish writings called Mishnas, and they're essentially like a commentary on the Old Testament. And there's an old Jewish Mishnah written by a rabbi, and he talks about Esther and the third day. And he says, Abraham was told to kill Isaac. And on the third day, he found life in the midst of death when God said, or God showed him a ram. Jonah was sent into the belly of a fish. And on the third day, he found life in the midst of death when he was spit out of that fish and sent to Nineveh. And Esther, on the third day, after in death identifying under the death sentence of her people, she finds life. And this is an old Jewish Mishnah writing about the story of Esther. Not a Christian, this is a rabbi. And he says, isn't it interesting how God often brings life from death on the third day? The story of Esther is pointing us to a bigger and a better story. Like Mordecai, we are under the king's edict, deserving to die. Like Mordecai, we cannot enter the king's presence because we are wearing unacceptable garments. Not sackcloth and ashes, but lives stained by sin. Like Esther, Jesus is in a heavenly palace. Like Esther, Jesus sacrificed the glories of that palace to identify with his people. Like Esther, Jesus risked his life to intercede for his people. But unlike Esther, whose life was spared after 3 days of fasting, Jesus' life was resurrected after 3 days in the grave. Do you see this story is pointing you to a much bigger story? I would invite you to find yourself in that bigger story before you look to follow any character in this story. If you're a Christian, you can be used by God. You can do great things for God. You can take incredible risks to follow Jesus because in light of the cross, you have nothing else to lose. You've already lost everything. You've died to yourself. And when you were dipped under the waters of baptism, the old you died. The world says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Christians say, eat, drink, and be merry, because yesterday we were dead. You have nothing else to risk, Christian. The worst that can happen to you, with the biggest risk imaginable, is that you will get to see the eyes of Jesus Christ. Find yourself in that story. If you're not a follower of Jesus, I would invite you to repent and believe. See, unlike the Jewish people, we actually deserve death. We sinned against a holy God. And there's no way we can enter into the king's presence. We're defiled by our sin. We need a middleman. We need an intercessor. We need a mediator. And there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. Look upon him and live. And then identify with his people through baptism. Make it public. I'd like, if I may, to conclude this morning by just giving you two principles on how we should live in light of this part of the story. Here's number one. When you can't see very far, go as far as you can see. When you can't see very far, go as far as you can see. If you're here, you're a follower of Jesus, and risk is scary for you. And by risk, I'm not talking about just doing crazy things. I'm going to go skydiving. Pastor talked about risk. This is great. No. What risk for the sake of the gospel, using your influence to reach the nation, the people you have influence over, using that influence to win them, to rescue them, to help them. That's what we're talking about, risking in that way. When you think about that, it's scary. And if we're honest, we would like God to just give us a burning bush. And some of you think, man, following God in the Old Testament would be so much easier. You get fleeces that are wet and the ground's dry, and you get burning bushes, and you get, you know, God speaking to you through prophets. Did you notice what was absent in Esther chapter 4? Any mention of God. By the way, God is not mentioned in the entire book. Esther has to make this decision completely on her own, being led, we trust, by God. But she gets no sign. She gets no burning bush. She gets no clouds in the sky that tell her what to do. She just does something. And maybe as far as she could see was, I'm just going to do a banquet. I don't know what to do next. And maybe as far as she could see that night was, I don't know what to say, how to do it. I'm just going to do another banquet and then I'll tell. But she went as far as she could see. I've shared this with you all before, but if you knew me 3 years ago, you would probably not want to follow me as your pastor. I was indecisive, nervous, anxiety-ridden wreck. I couldn't make decisions, not big ones. I was terrified of making the wrong one. Some of you can relate with that. I spent a decade in seminary, and the nice thing about seminary is when you decide what classes do I take next year, you just have to follow the order in the catalog, right? It's pretty easy. You kind of have a sign from heaven right there, right from the alumni office, right? There's your sign. There was no hard decisions that I had to make for a while. So 3 years ago, as I can see, I'm not going to be able to provide for my family, pastoring 30 folks, and my family's growing, and I don't know what to do. And here's this Pakwasan church calling. I don't know what to do. This is terrifying. I was a frantic mess. I couldn't make a decision. And I remember two conversations that helped me incredibly. One was my loving wife, who said, Hobson, I don't care if you make a bad decision, just make a decision. Sometimes men, we need that kind of kick in the pants, you know? Incidentally, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, if you don't know about him, Google him. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was incredibly instrumental in a plot to assassinate Hitler. He's a pastor, theologian, okay? And one of the things he said in German World War II times, here's what he said, often delaying a decision or making no decision is worse than making the wrong decision out of faith and love. Christian, just do something. Risk something. What's on your heart? Do you care about the unborn? Then risk. Do you care about marriages? Then take a risk and do something. Is God calling you to do something hard and painful and difficult? Will it hurt you? Do it. And when you can't see very far, just go as far as you can see and take the next step, and He'll give you more light as you go. Can I tell you, Christian, obedience is always risky. Always. Here's a second principle in light of this story. When you can't trace God's hand, trust His heart. When you can't trace God's hand, trust His heart. Again, it's noteworthy that the name of God is not mentioned anywhere in the entire book of Esther. If His name was going to be mentioned anywhere, it would be right here. I think this is the only place in the Bible that I can think of, and maybe you find it, show me, I'd love to see it, but where people are publicly fasting and wearing sackcloth and ashes, and it doesn't say that they're praying. Even the Ninevites knew how to pray when they fasted and wore sackcloth and ashes. I don't think it's that God's people are not praying in this part of the story. But I think the author deliberately doesn't mention that so that you can see even when God appears to be absent, He's there. When you can't trace His hand and life hurts, and I promise you, Christian, if you risk for the gospel, if you risk for the unborn, if you risk for the sake of the nations, if you risk to use your influence and your job so that people might know Jesus, if you risk, it will hurt. I promise you. But when life hurts, and when you can't trace God's hand, trust His heart. We began our time this morning thinking about a fun little trip to the beach. In 1875, there's a lady named Louisa Stead that took a fun trip to the beach with her family in Long Island. It was supposed to be a nice picnic lunch by the water, Louisa and her daughter and her husband. And as they were enjoying their time together as a family, her husband heard screaming from the water. There was somebody that was caught in an undertow. And so Louisa's husband ran in to rescue this person that was drowning, and Louisa's husband died in the process. Incredible suffering. Incredible suffering. But that's not why we remember Louisa Stead. We remember Louisa because of the words that she wrote, words that we'll sing in just a moment, after the loss of her husband. "'Tis so sweet to trust in Jesus, just to take Him at His word, just to rest upon His promise, just to know, thus saith the Lord. Jesus, Jesus, how I trust Him. How I've proved Him o'er and o'er. Jesus, Jesus, precious Jesus. Oh, for grace to trust Him more." Let's pray together and then we'll sing.